Hey guys, welcome back to the mainstream. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and with me is my co-host, Joe Turk. How are you doing, Joe?
Doing great. I'm looking forward to another, more Spielberg talk.
More Spielberg talk, because one just wasn't enough. He's like, we're not for an hour. So basically this is 2 hours, most likely, you know, that we can, I mean, I bet we could talk hours on Spielberg since he's got so much, but, yeah. And what I was actually thinking is the movies I just watched, the two that, we're definitely going to be diving into, those could have their own like episodes, you know, where you could just talk and talk and talk. So us actually just talking like 5 or 10 minutes on these is definitely not enough in a way.
Yeah, I'm thinking one of those could be a Film Freaks or something, but
it probably will be. I know I have this feeling Minority Report will be for me.
Yeah,
at some
exactly.
Point.
Yep.
I don't think, and we'll get into my Schindler's List feelings. And there are some feelings, but let's first talk about. You just told me a little bit ago that you just watched Duel for the first time. So let's go into that.
Yes. Yeah, I got a Blu-ray box set of some of Spielberg's Universal films. So I was really amped to see Duel, and I really enjoyed it.
Did you just buy that box set like after this thing, or did you already have it?
No, I got it right afterwards because I was like, how can I see Duel? How can I see Sugarman Express? A couple of the ones that I hadn't seen before. So I was like, let me get these. And I saw the package and I was like, well, I can add a Blu-ray of Jaws out of it. Sure.
Right. Right.
It's not 4K or anything, but got that and was able to watch Duel there. And I saw they had like a documentary on it too, where they talked about a little bit more and I read a little bit about it. And I didn't realize that it was I think you might have mentioned it, but that it was really shot to be a TV movie. You know, shot like really quick for a quick turnaround. And but I loved the that it's basically a very simple premise, but he had such a deft ability to make so many different angles, camera angles, and shots that made it seem so wide open yet so claustrophobic on the main character. I can't remember the actor's name, Dennis Weaver.
I'm not sure if it is or not, but like it feels like it's the grandfather of all those other, you know, car chase either a person in the car or a car itself chasing people, like Christine or Joyride or the car or whatever. You know, I think Joyride in a way is very much is its own little remake of it without
Breakdowns. Yeah, Breakdown's another one.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Wasn't that Claire Danes or something, or is that
I remember it was JT Walsh was the bad guy, and Kurt Russell, I believe, was the.
Oh no, I was thinking Broke Down Palace. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. This one. Walsh. I think he passed away a few years after that. Not too long after that, but he was very imposing truck driver.
Yeah, I remember Kurt. Terrorized. I think it was like Kurt Russell. You said right. So
But Duel. I was really impressed, especially for being a first film too. I mean, it's just. That one really impressed me, but I mean, I guess it shouldn't be that impressed necessarily to be easy to be impressed with Spielberg. Because everything he does just about is good on some level, but this was really.
Yeah, I would agree. And what I would say also is that I saw like clips and pieces of his first like feature film Firelight, which he did. I don't remember if we talked about that or not in the thing, but he did it with like his friends, right? Like, and people around the town that he lived in Arizona. He shot these, you know, and it became the antithesis for, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. So it became the thing that, you know, brought, Close Encounters, you know, to the foray, because he wanted to do a sci-fi thing like that. And I absolutely loved Firelight because like for like a 16-year-old kid, it was pretty freaking amazing. Now, Steven Spielberg, I believe, has like not disowned it, but like, you know, I'm pretty sure he looks back at it and goes, I could have done, you know, I could have done better as a kid, you know. Yeah. That's what all, you know, dogs.
Yeah. Say. Well, in Duel, some of his trademark things he touched on, I noticed right away, like when Weaver was at the restaurant, he there was some in a laundromat, there was some circles and stuff like that, like the camera shot did some shots through circles. He always seems to have circles as part of his thing. Some of the tracking shots with the car, I mentioned that the rear view mirror, he seems to always like to do those in a lot of his shots of reflections in the mirror and stuff like that. So it seemed like this was where it all kind of began in a full length feature sense. So was glad I saw that, and really glad that I own it on Blu-ray now. But following
that, that's awesome. Like, yeah. that's a good one, you know, to have, because I'm sure that the look on it, you know, looked a lot better, you know, than what, you know, like it's probably in HD, it looks sharper.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was a lot, it looked a lot cleaner than some of the video, the previews that I saw online and stuff like that, which looked pretty dated, if you will. But yeah. You consider the movie was what 50 years old now. It's almost 50 years old. So that was really good. I followed that up watching Sugarland Express. And that one I thought was pretty good. It didn't blow me away. It didn't do like what Duel did, but very young Goldie Hawn in it.
Nice.
And just basically another road film where they're on the run and there's people chasing people and stuff like that. So there was that element that was kind of similar.
There's a little bit of a theme there, because I think like his first short film or something was about some people just walking down the road or whatever, you know, like he likes the road, you know.
Yeah. And I think they joked about it on one of the documentaries on either Duel or Sugarland Express. He's like, I didn't want to be pigeonholed into doing that. And it was interesting because he went from that to Jaws, and it's just, I mean, talk about a stark contrast in type of films. So Sugarland Express, I wouldn't put up there as one of the best films or anything like that, but I mean, it was okay. I mean, it was decent. I mean, it's one now I own it 'cause it's part of the pack, but it's not something that I'll probably seek out necessarily as much as say Duel. Other than that, the other one that I watched was War Horse, but I think maybe we could talk about that if we're going through chronologically.
Yeah,
it's one of his newer ones.
Yeah, so we didn't really get to those parts. So we're going to circle back and we're going to talk about Minority Report, because that kind of bridges, you know, because you watched two, then you watched was one that I haven't seen and one that I did see, and one I did watch was Minority Report, so we can talk about that. I absolutely fucking love that movie. It's very rare these days that a movie comes along that I either haven't seen or that, you know, or whatever, but like had I seen it like years ago, it would be like probably up there as my number, like one of my number one favorite movies, like up there, like, I don't know, top five. I can't say that yet because I only saw it once, and I tend to not, you know, I tend to want to watch it later, you know, to give it kind of some time to like say, okay, is this really worth it? You know, but it was surprisingly really freaking good. Like, cause I mean, to me, because like, I love Philip K. Dick. You know, I absolutely love Blade Runner. I love Running Man. I think he did Running Man. He's done a ton of amazing sci-fi movies or sci-fi books that got turned into movies. And Minority Report is definitely up there. It's one of those films that I'm just, every time when I watched it, I was just like, this just blew me away. I couldn't believe how freaking good this was. The thing that caught me like into it was just the theme of the movie of you know, the idea that if we were, you know, if somebody were to be able to arrest you before you committed a crime, before you committed murder, you know, would that save people's lives, right? Problem with that being is, like, if you're the one who gets, you know, and you haven't done anything, that's not really fair, you know, right? And that's like, you know, the story, you know, Tom Cruise having to go and, you know, it just made me think about it. Like, I mean, it would suck if I, like, knew I was going to murder somebody and then I got arrested. Like, I mean, makes more sense if you're, like, in the middle of the act of doing it, right? But the dude knew, like, you know, before then, before he was even going to commit the crime, you know, should he just turn himself in or should he run? Like, it was such a good, like, thriller idea, you know, up all the way up to the end. And if you haven't seen Minority Report, I absolutely adore, like just go see it. You know, I recommend it. What are your thoughts after seeing it again?
Well, I can't believe that I waited like almost 10, 15 years since last time that I seen it. Cause it's almost, it's what, 18, 19 years old now. So, I had it on DVD and, I'm going to probably seeking that one out on Blue or 4K down the road. The evolution of the story in the futuristic world, what, 2054 or whatever the year was they chose, that's one piece of the puzzle, but the attention to detail that they took, listening on like a documentary, they talked about that they had like a 75 page Bible basically of that the future would look like in that time for what they were trying to get through the story with. And seeing the screens, obviously watching, being able to move the hands in the screens and stuff like that, that always just, I remember that like it was yesterday, that part of it. Mm-hmm. But the attention, like with the spiders, those were cool. Yeah, how they would go in looking for to scan all the eyes to track all the people to try to track them down, and each one had its own little, a couple of them had their own little like nuanced emotional they were their own characters almost. A couple of them like the one that tried to pick up to go up underneath to figure out how to get into the one room where Cruise was hiding. That attention to detail, the sound was just amazing with that. Another thing that really caught my attention, and I had to follow up, do a little bit of looking into one of the documentaries talked about it, was the color of the film, and that it was kind of muted in some ways. And I was like, why did Spielberg and Janusz Kaminski decide to do that? Spielberg said he wanted it to be like his ugliest, like dirtiest film. So that was, he basically, they removed like almost 40% of the color of the film. And then what they did was that allowed them to put some attention on the lighting, which is one of Spielberg's thing, obviously, with the lighting. Yeah. Had the glowing lights around there. And when it had it on Samantha Morton's character, when she was talking about their Cruise's son in the future and stuff like that, it was almost like she was an angel. And it was just like, wow. This is every little, and that was in the house, I guess that was what they shot that in Gloucester, here in Virginia. Some of the film was filmed in Gloucester and Williamsburg, I believe, or they had some, I remember when they were here doing stuff too, making the film in the area, but, just did that attention to the visual nature of the film was one aspect, but and you touched a little bit on the story, and going into the different levels and how, Colin Farrell's character. I mean, Colin, he came in and I was just like, okay, he's just going to be a dick here. But I mean, there was obviously the curve thrown somewhat into the middle of the film with what his character, or towards the end with what his character really was, and with Sydal's character and all. But it could have just been a chase film, but they took the extra attention to detail and make it something more. And that's Spielberg.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I think that it was, that the amount of detail, not just for the visual aspect of it, but for the story aspect and for you actually caring about the characters, you know, and everything. Like, this is one of the first movies for a while that I actually cared about Tom Cruise. Like, I hate to say it, but Ethan Hunt, after a while, you just get kind of been like, he's just gonna, he's just going to survive again. And he's just going to, you know what I mean? Like things are just going to blow up. I mean, you don't care about him. Like there's no peril. He's not going to die, you know, like, and unless they're like, this is the final Mission Impossible and it's called goodbye, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, he's going to die. You just got to wait till when, like, that would be one thing. But like, honestly, it's like Tom Cruise, you watch him as Ethan Hunt, you watch him as Jack Reacher, you watch him as all these characters, you know he's not gonna die. This movie, I had no idea what was gonna happen. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I actually was like worried because I thought at the end it could have gone that way. And everything, and it was very, you know, I'm just saying, very close to like a different ending, you know, and everything. And I just absolutely adored it. And it was a movie that I was sitting around watching it because it's on Showtime and I've got the Showtime app now. And I was watching it going, this is fucking good. Like, this is, I mean, Steven Spielberg's good, you know, don't get me wrong. Like, there's hardly a bad Spielberg movie, you know, but this was pretty damn good. So there you go.
It's, upon second viewing, I was like, why haven't I watched this in the like before? And why don't I have this on Blue or something better? Cause I mean, cause it's definitely worthy film. And I mean, I know it pushes almost 2.5 hours, but most of his films, Spielberg's films, do now. But it didn't seem like it at all. I mean, it flew by.
That was one of the things I loved about the movie is like for a 2.5 hour long movie, like it did not feel like that other than the movie that we're going to talk about next, which, you know, which did.
I'd say Minority Report probably at least the, in my opinion, 1A, it's probably the best film that he's done in the past 20 years. Easy.
Right.
In the 2000s forward.
Like I honestly, so far, it's really hard because I've seen a bunch of the other movies that I would put up there in my top five. I definitely put it in my top five. I think it would be up there as like third or fourth, you know.
Really?
Number one, obviously, being Jaws, and I don't think he could ever make another movie that would defeat Jaws. But if you do, Steven, you know, like, do it.
I'll be so thankful. That would be amazing.
Actually, it's really funny. Because I was actually just saying, okay, never mind. I'll say this in a second, in a little bit. But this movie is just like up. Jaws is my favorite, you know, and I'll be there very thankful if something beat it because that just meant that he just made another amazing movie, you know.
Absolutely.
Like this, if I could give 5-star ratings, Jaws would get a 5. Jurassic Park would get a 4.5, and I think Minority Report would get a 4. You know. 4, you know, maybe 4.5 still, like up there, because I adore this movie, and Jurassic Park is once again another one of those movies that I absolutely love too. I think he does really well with horror, you know, but like not horror, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
PG-13 horror, you know. And I think that's amazing. And Minority Report was PG-13, it was R-rated, but it was like, I mean, for an R-rated movie, it really wasn't that, I mean, you know, it wasn't that bad, you know.
Was it R? I couldn't remember if it was R or
I think
not,
it was R. Probably for cursing, you know.
A second viewing or more recent viewing, definitely. I was in awe of the greatness that film was. But so I guess going into your other one that you just watched, it's a kind of a transition here.
Well, we were just talking about horror, and it's a different kind of horror. I was actually thinking it was funny. I almost forgot about Jaws and Jurassic Park both being horror films because they both feel like adventure films, not horror films, really.
Yeah.
But they both have elements of horror. This movie was a drama with elements of horror, you know, and it's Schindler's List. And it is a movie that I watched for the very first time. It took me 3 days to watch it. you know, watch the first like 15 minutes, and I watch another like an hour and 15 or whatever it was. And I finished it off with another like last hour and 15 minutes and everything. And it's a movie that I'll probably never watch again. Like, you know, I'm grateful it exists. I'm grateful I watched it. I'm glad I did not sit in a theater to watch it. It's an amazing masterpiece of a movie, you know, like me saying I don't want to watch it is just because of the subject matter. And it was, I think we talked about this in the last one, like the reason I did not originally want to watch Schindler's List is because of the subject matter. Like I'm like, I can see documentaries about it. I don't have to, it's just like watching Passion of the Christ. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like I can read the book. You know, I don't need to like see it. And I still haven't watched Passion of the Christ. I have like 3 or 4 copies of it on DVD, you know, different copies or whatever. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched it yet because I don't know if like that's something I really want to watch. Like, I don't think I need to sit down and watch it, you know? Mm-hmm. Schindler's List, I watched because we were doing this and I kind of wanted to at least talk about it or something and have a little discussion. But once again, it's like one of those movies we were talking about earlier that like before we started the podcast that we could watch, we could do like a Film Freaks on it, or I guess no Steven Spielberg's ever been on Criterion. So, you know, but we could do a Film Freaks about Minority Report. I wouldn't do one on Schindler's List because it's just, I mean, even though there's a lot to talk about, I wouldn't want to watch it again in order to do it. Like it's, I don't know.
To prepare for the discussion and all, I watched pieces of it again, and I watched a documentary or two on it. I haven't seen it since, mm-hmm. I mean, since I saw it in the theaters, and that's been 25 years ago or whatever. But I remember that experience vividly, and it still hits me. I mean, I remember the exact theater that I saw it in and everything. And it's still to this day. It's what films to me can be if for certain aspects of life. I mean, most of the time life is about escapism and stuff like that, about fun and enjoyment. But when you really want to get some serious, tell a story the right way, this is the epitome of that. And right. to me, it's beyond a film. It's more of an experience.
I absolutely agree. What I love about the movie is obviously, as people have said, because I posted that last night, obviously you saw I posted last mm-hmm. night that I was watching it for the first time. And I got a lot of people that were like, oh my God, you haven't seen this movie. And I'm like, no, it was 1993 when it came out. I was 11. You know, when it came out, this would not be a movie for an 11-year-old to watch, you know? And so when I grew up, I had heard so many like horror stories about how hard it is to watch that movie because of the subject matter. So I avoided it for the longest time. And then I'm like, well, I might as well watch it. And like, if I don't like it or something, or if I can't take it, I can always turn it off, you know? And I was tempted to do that and you know, yesterday when I was watching it, because like last night when I watched it, some of it, it's too violent. This is like probably, other than Saving Private Ryan, you know, mm-hmm. this is probably one of his, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. but this is probably one of his most violent films, you know, and it's grim, it's dark. For mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg movie, like he's generally got, and of course the ending is more light in a way, you know, it's like gives a glimmer of hope, which is
the redemption. Yeah.
Which is what Spielberg does. And I really, really like Liam Neeson. I did. I really liked him, especially where he's a member of the Nazi party. He is friends with all these Jewish people, you know, right. And he ends up, you know, being told like, you know, like one of his lines is, how am I, what was the, I don't know the exact line, but it was something to the effect of, you know, all these people are being, you know, put into the, you know, put into all this stuff. What am I supposed to do about it? You know, right? Mm-hmm. And he gets his answer, and his answer is, you know, work with everybody to actually, like, give them jobs that make them essential, and kind of steal them away from these people so that he can mm-hmm. kind of do that, and then run away after it's done. Yeah. And he does exactly what he needs to do to pull this off, and he becomes this, like, in a way, he becomes a very big hero at the end of the. Because I always thought Schindler's List was like, I thought I always thought he was the bad guy, period. You know, and I thought mm-hmm. that's all it was. But no, just like Spielberg does, he likes to, at, you know, toward the end of the movie, the guy's seeing all these nasty things happen. I mean, you know, like yeah. it was. Now, there are some moments that make it feel so real, but there's also moments where I'm just like, do we need that realness? You know, like there was a great scene, don't get me wrong, but this woman who was a worker who told them, you know, don't, you know, you shouldn't be putting this up there. You're going to ruin the place if you, you know, you got to rebuild it and everything. And the guy's like, shoot her, you know, for disobeying us, you know, or whatever. Then they shoot her in front of everybody. And then he walks away and says, all right, rebuild it, like she said, you know, basically showing that, you know, you don't disagree with these people. But like, did we need that? Did we absolutely positively need that scene? I mean, it would have been great if they cut it and then had it as a deleted scene to show, you know what I mean? But like, it was absolutely not. I don't know. I felt like there was just too much going on in that movie and made it too long. And it's just a hard movie to watch all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he's basically a profiteer at the beginning, just war profiting on war and stuff like that. And to show his realization of what was happening there and how he transitioned it to where he could know that he's going to have to go on the run. But I think the reason Spielberg showed everything was just to continue the impact. And I understand what you're saying, how it could be limited. If you understand if it happens, they show it a few times, but he kept putting it over, like hitting us over the head with it. But I think that was done with the intent of making us not become numb from it. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it can't be. Yeah, I mean, if somebody comes out of the blue and says, yeah, I could watch that movie over and over again, outside of the filmmaking aspects of it, which is so beyond sound, it's unbelievable.
All right, so if you haven't seen Schindler's List, by the way, I'm going to spoil something that, you know, Joe didn't spoil the last time because he didn't want to spoil it in front of me or whatever. That ending, amazing. Like, just the fact that the ending in color, there's two little bits in color. There's a girl, you know, that's in red. To me,
that's the most horrific part, is seeing her, but we can go into that in a minute. But
and then at the end of the movie, everybody goes into color when it's the end, and it's like night. I don't know what year it was that it was supposed to be, but all the people are giving their respects to the grave of Oscar Schindler. So I thought that was,
and that's like, yeah, and that was like the real survivors and stuff like,
yeah,
that.
I figured that was, they never said that, but mm-hmm. I figured those are the real survivors. They got them, and I was like, that's so fucking sweet to go, like, Hollywood called all of those people up and said, hey, you know, why don't we do this for the end of the movie? And you know what I mean, like, that was sweet. I like that. You know?
The part I think I mentioned on the previous one, and we just touched on a little bit with about the girl in the dress, and then it's like when it shows her that spoiler that obviously people have seen it, I'm sure, by now, and you've seen it.
And if they haven't, they can fast forward those.
Yeah,
cause, you know,
yeah. And when they show her on her dead on the wheelbarrow thing, just getting wheeled away, it's like, to me, that is. It's beyond sad because it puts such a personal feel to it that's even beyond just numbers. And when I read something on the making of it that Spielberg told the actress that played that girl and told her family that do not watch this movie until you're an adult. And she actually, her family watched it when she was like 11 or so, and they were horrified, not negatively to him, but just because of the what it was. And I mean, and to me that it's hard. We've talked a little bit about our favorite movies of Spielberg and stuff like that. And to me, it's hard for me to even quantify this movie in that sense of favorite movie or his best movie and stuff like that, because I don't even look at this as a movie per se. It's an experience, and that's why it's like I can't even necessarily rank it because right. it's something else. And I own it on DVD. I got it and I wanted to see some of the documentaries that was on it, but I don't know if I could sit and watch it again. Now I watched it when I was 21, so I'm a totally different person now,
right?
But I still the pieces that I watched, just trying to get reacclimated to it, and then it's like as soon as I start, I was like, wait, I remember this now. I remember sitting in the theater and so from a serious aspects of this film, there's also I think Spielberg said that he had to watch something at night, like he watched a sitcom or something like that. I think it might have been Seinfeld or one of those. He watched every night just to try to relax himself because he was so overwhelmed. And it took him 10 years to make this movie. And he said he couldn't make it when he was younger. He got to the point of maturity in his life to where he's able to reconcile that, his faith, his relationship and his family and all those different things. And to me, there's no finer aspects to a film that he'll probably ever do. But if I never see it again, I understand.
Right.
and also one of the other things, and to make it a little bit lighter, a transition here, this might have been mentioned in one of other podcasts, but there was an episode of Seinfeld. I don't know if you have.
I've heard about it.
Seinfeld. Okay, where.
I love Seinfeld, but I don't remember this particular.
Okay, it's when Schindler's List was out in the theaters and stuff like that. So, but there was a scene that Jerry, he couldn't, he was seeing his girlfriend and stuff like that. And his parents were staying with them. They were up from Florida, so they were staying with him in his place. So he didn't have any way of getting any private time with his girlfriend. So him and his girlfriend went to see Schindler's List because they knew that they'd get 3 hours in a private theater to themselves. They were kissing or whatever. Anyways, Newman saw him in there and caused all sorts of a ruckus, saying, how can you ever make out in this type of film and stuff like that? So it took the seriousness of, without denigrating anything truly about Schindler's List, but showing how it's like, how you can even contemplate doing anything but other than just feeling a sense of dread experiencing the film is it played for comedic laughs in Seinfeld, obviously, but it deals with the aspects of how great that Schindler's List is.
Yeah, so I think that's really funny because that you're just saying earlier that Steven Spielberg was watching sitcoms like Seinfeld and maybe Seinfeld, and then Seinfeld sort of poked a little fun at it in a way, like not in a mean spirited way or whatever, but in a way saying like, this is a fucking serious movie. How could you be, you know, doing that's sort of, and I bet Steven Spielberg got a good kick out of that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that his, you know, that it all kind of comes full circle in a way.
Yeah.
So I like that.
So, transitioning from Schindler's List, I know there's other films that he, I guess what would be next up on the list would be after Schindler's List. He obviously, that one won the Oscar, and I don't think he won director for it, because I don't think he, there was something about he didn't win an Oscar for the longest time. I can't remember if it was the background on all that, but from there he went on and did obviously Jurassic Park 2, and then Amistad and Saving Private Ryan. And right. I guess we're going to another gut punch there. Well, Amistad as well, from what I've heard. I personally still haven't seen it.
But, yeah, I saw it years ago in the theater, and I think I told you earlier, like, it bored me when I watched it. I think I watched it, like, 1998, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was, I believe I was, like, a junior in high school or something. So I know, like, you know, it wasn't a movie that, like, I particularly would, like, seek out again, you know, in my mind. I mean, I might have a better respect for it now as, mm-hmm. you know, a filmmaker and, you know, the fact that my ADHD is still kicks me. So it's hard to watch, like, you know, like it was hard. Like I said, three days to watch 3 hours of the 3 hours and 15 minutes of a movie. And just, it was to me, it was just too long. And we've talked about that, like that he does like to put a lot of his movies too long. But I don't remember much about Amistad. I just remember I wasn't a big fan and I wasn't, it's funny to know that Matthew McConaughey was in it, you know, with like, I think Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, this would have been McConaughey. That would have been right after like Time to Kill and stuff like that. So it was really early. And when obviously he started out and I remember his first movie was a horror film, the first Chainsaw or Chainsaw Fourth, 4 or yeah. 5 or whatever.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
Yeah, him and Renee Zellweger together, I think, was in that first, one of his first roles. But following Amistad up with Saving Private Ryan, which I guess continuing, I guess he was in a part of his life that he was just dealing with different adult themes that just really gut-wrenching, because I'm Saving Private Ryan, I'm sure just about everybody's seen that. The first, like, is it 15, 20 minutes of that movie is just absolutely it's probably the most intense war scene that I've ever seen. I remember in the theaters I had to put my popcorn down. I had to stop, and it was just like, oh my god.
You know me, I'm not a huge war fan, so war movie fan. I think it's kind of, I mean, it's cool, you know, whatever, but like we reviewed 1917, which I really, really, really enjoyed, but, it's really hard for me to like, just sit around and watch a bunch of great actors, you know, right? You look at so many, Saving Private Ryan had a huge cast that was of like amazing actors, you know, in it. And after a while, they sort of start blending in. I'm like, I don't know who these people are, what they're, you know, all I know is they've got one mission is to go find Private Ryan and save him. That's it. Like, that's their mission, you know, or whatever. And to survive, you know, and to win the war, you know what I mean? Like, it's just sort of like, okay, you know, like it doesn't do anything. War movies don't do anything to me. I mean, I would never make one. Except for, you know, like a horror war movie or something, you know, or whatever. But like, I wouldn't make like a war movie.
So you'd probably do something like Overlord or something like that.
Yeah, like a zombie war movie. Yeah, I would do that. Like, you know, that would be fun, you know.
It starts out as a war film, but then it turns around. There's like a mad doctor scientist underneath it all.
Soldiers, you know, things like that. But, you know, I would never make like a war movie because I mean, I respect war movies because they go through, I mean, they do a lot of research. Mm-hmm. They go into like, they actually have names of actual people and they know what they've done and they know how they did it. And they, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I respect it. Not for me though. Like, I, you know, there's some movies, Westerns, not for me. I used to not even like pirate movies. And Kim would love to hear this, but I've gotten into swashbuckling, you know, pirate movies and stuff years later in life, you know.
So you haven't seen Saving Private Ryan, or you saw it, but it's just not your.
Oh, I saw it.
Because there was in that movie, and I know we'll probably move on to the next one here pretty quickly, but there was a scene in there that obviously the first 20 minutes is crazy, but there's a scene later on to where there's a knife fight between one of the soldiers and Adam Goldberg's character, and ultimately Goldberg it shows him dying by getting stabbed slowly in his chest by in a hand to hand, and it's just like. And you just see him, the life coming out of him. It's probably one of the best acting that Goldberg's done in his career. that sequence. But in general,
poor Adam Goldberg, man. Like, I swear to God, I love that guy. Like, every time I see him, I go crazy, like going, "Oh my God, that's Adam Goldberg!" Like, I know him. Like, I know of, like, I don't know him personally, but I know, like, I've seen so many of his things, and he pops in all TV shows. Like, he was in Entourage for a couple episodes. He was in,
he has
Dazed and Confused. I mean. Yeah. He's been in a ton of movies.
He has his TV show too, the Goldbergs, that's sort of he it's his life inspiration and stuff like that.
What?
You didn't know that?
No, that. I mean, I know that's the 80s show and everything. I did not know that was Adam.
It's supposedly based on his childhood and stuff, but
that's funny.
But with Saving Private Ryan, that he, obviously a smaller
that's where role that's where he's it. Been. Jesus, I was. Yeah. He's like, where the hell did Adam Goldberg go? And he is like, it's like, yeah, dude, I'm fine. Don't worry about me.
Yeah, the last movie I've seen him in, he did a movie with, I believe it was with Julie Delpy a few years ago. Like 2 days in Paris or something.
Either
like
one
Paris
of them directed it. I think it's Julie might have directed it and stuff.
Yeah, it was. I guess for her, it was something similar to Before Sunrise, Before Sunset series. But it was obviously no Ethan Hawke and Adam Goldberg took the role.
And it was no Richard Linklater written movie. Yeah, like it's, yeah. I think Julie wrote and directed it, and I had no real interest in it. I love Before Sunrise and all the movies. I'm not interested in seeing some sort of knockoff of it, you know, like, but you know, and honestly, I like Adam Goldberg a lot, but I think Ethan Hawke's a much better actor.
Well, Ethan Hawke, he's big time. There. So after Saving Private Ryan, I guess we go into the 2000s, and that's when you start. That's when we go into his he returns back to but it's more with adult themes now. But he returns back to some of the computer stuff and some of this alien aspects of life and the space and the future with AI and Minority Report. So I mean, and it's stuff that he was mentioning on one of the documentaries I was listening to that it was him turning into the 50s. He was going into his 50s, so he was just starting to look at a different stage of his life. So you could just see the natural transition going from the war films of the mid to late 90s outside of the Jurassic Parks to this. So and we touched on Minority Report for a little while earlier, but
remember when Haley Joel Osment was cute, like this cute little kid, you know?
Yeah, between like, that and Sixth Sense and stuff like that.
And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, when he got older, I'm like, dude. You know,
I saw a picture of him. I was like, that's Haley. I didn't even realize it was him. I you never know what any of us are going to be like when compared to when we were small and et cetera. But,
He was, I don't know. He was a cool kid, but he kind of grew up to be like, I really don't like his beard and all the stuff that he does right now. I just think he looks really weird, and he's, I saw him in the Entourage movie and saw him in Tusk, and I was like, but whatever.
Yeah. So AI, I remember I enjoyed it, but I haven't seen it in forever. And it's, I mean, I'm not chomping at the bit to get back to it, but,
yeah,
I mean, I enjoyed it, but, then you go into like some of the other, his other stuff. After
I like what part. What I liked about it was that it was originally Stanley Kubrick. It was Stanley Kubrick's, you know, baby. You know, and Steven decided, you know, let's get it done. And basically, based on what he got from prototypes and different stuff from Stanley Kubrick. However, Spielberg is no Stanley Kubrick. They're completely different people, you know, different directors. So it would have been interesting to see Kubrick's take on it, you know?
Yeah, so I'd be interested to know, and I don't know if you know the details of this or not, but if he... did Spielberg get like Kubrick's blessing before Kubrick passed away to make this, or was it like sort of a team effort or whatever? I mean, I'd be interested to know some of the backstory to that, if there is much, or if it was basically just that he picked it up because Kubrick couldn't do it.
Okay. Stanley Kubrick worked on the project for 2 decades before his death. But along the way, he decided to ask Steven Spielberg to direct, saying it was closer to his sensibilities. The two collaborated for several years, resulting in Kubrick giving Spielberg a complete story treatment and lots of conceptual art for the movie prior to the death, which Spielberg used to write his own scenario. Contrary to popular belief, Spielberg claims that he introduced many of the darker elements into the story, while Kubrick's main contribution consisted mostly of its sweeter parts. In a 2002 interview with the movie critic Joe Layden, Spielberg indicated that the middle part of the movie, including the flesh fair, was his idea, whereas the first 40 minutes, the teddy bear, and the last 20 minutes were taken straight from Kubrick's story. Ian Watson, who wrote Kubrick's original treatment, confirmed that even the much criticized ending, assumed by many to be typical Spielberg edition, was exactly what he wrote for Stanley and exactly what he wanted, filmed faithfully by Spielberg. So there you go. That should answer.
Now I'm a little more interested to see it again.
Like it's on the Showtime app, just like Minority Report. So I may want to check it out again too. Hmm. It's been a while. I remember the teddy bear and I remember the kid and I remember it was AI. It was artificial. You know what I mean?
I'm
gonna see how much it's like, you know, models like what's going on here. You know?
Yeah. So after AI and we talked about Minority Report, Catch Me If You Can, I remember I really enjoyed that. It was kind of, I don't say lighthearted, but it had sort of a fun element to it.
It was cute. I think he wanted to go cute after like doing these like sci-fi darker kind of movies and stuff. You know, he wanted to go back to kind of the more Frank Capra like. A lot of people compare Spielberg to Capra, I think, you know, I mean, if anyone was going to do remake like It's a Wonderful Life or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, it would be Spielberg, you know, like that's who you'd probably go to for those movies because, you know, they're very similar. But, you know, and that's funny because like he doesn't remake those movies. He remakes stuff like War of the Worlds, which is not like what you would think of them, but we'll get that in a little bit.
That was next up. After the terminal, which I
hated the terminal. I hated
that. The terminal. Like, I have it on DVD and I honestly can't remember why.
It was one of my least favorite Spielberg movies. Like,
yeah, I mean,
I felt like it was just so bland and boring. Mm-hmm. You know, Tom Hanks is amazing and everything, but like even that movie, he just didn't do anything for me. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I have, and like I said, I still don't even understand. I remember I must've got it really on the cheap or something War of the Worlds was after that. And, interesting thing that about that one is, I did a tour of one of the sites down there and out in California, and they had a War of the Worlds set there on one of the back lots, and it was like where the plane crash
scene
took place. So I got to see that. Other than that, I remember enjoying the movie, but it's been ages since I've even thought about it.
Yeah, I don't really remember either. I think I watched it years ago and everything. I don't even know if I watched the whole thing of it, you know? Like, I just, it wasn't something that really gripped me or excited me, so.
Yeah, then he followed up with Munich, which was
another movie I had no interest in. Like,
well, that another little gut punch. I mean, not as deep as Saving Private Ryan, or not nearly as much as Schindler's List. But telling the story of the ones who basically tracking down the people who did the killing in Munich at the Olympics. And I remember it being really obviously a very serious film. He was trying to do a little bit of a balance there. And I mean, and that's good. I mean, but I haven't really sought that one out again after seeing it 15 years ago.
Right.
So there's a handful of these right around this time period. That's just, I mean, the one that follows that is definitely, I mean, it's the worst of the Indiana Jones, in my opinion.
Oh God.
Let's not even talk
about that. I don't even think that deserves to, because I was actually, Rick, who we had on Hollywood Boulevard podcast for the Jane Silent Bob, he was watching that the other day. And was it Rick or was it somebody else? It wasn't Rick. It was somebody else said that they were watching Kingdom of the Lost Skull. And I was like, it wasn't terrible. Like, it wasn't like, you know, it was not the worst Spielberg movie, but, or whatever, but it was definitely the worst Indiana Jones movie in my opinion.
Oh, yeah,
but it's really hard. It's really hard to top the first three anyway. Like, those first three were amazing, you know, and definitely worth watching like over and over again. You know, yeah, but
so, but moving from that, he gets into the 2010s and Adventures of Tintin. That's one of the other ones that I have not seen. So there's two there that I haven't seen.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. It's on Prime apparently.
Yeah. I saw it on there, but I'm not rushing to see it. I'd rather watch a couple of these older ones that get to see Color Purple again after all these years. Minority Report. I just saw Raiders of the Lost Ark again on the big screen, which was nice. Seeing some of the old ones in the theater, not Spielberg directed, but I got to see Back to the Future and Goonies on the big screen in the past month too. So more Spielberg stuff there, but Tintin I'll probably watch at some point.
You watched War Horse though.
Yes, I watched War Horse, and to be honest, the first hour and a half I was like, okay, extremely well made. I mean, that goes without saying with all his stuff, but it was just it didn't have anything that really made me feel like so emotional. And then there was a spell there about because the movie's almost 2.5 hours long. Mm-hmm. So about 45 minutes to about 15 minutes left, there's a spell there that, and it's a little contrived, and I don't believe it's a true story. I doubt that it is. But I mean, if it is, then wow. But it's a little contrived in how some of the events that happened in it. But it started to really hit me emotionally, and I was I was really kind of surprised. I was like, wow, this is actually turning here a little bit. And then the last 10, 15 minutes, it sort of played out like sort of how I envisioned it to. But good film. Nothing. I'll probably never look at it again. But it was pretty good, and it had some really good high points, but there were some points it was like, okay, this is a little dragging here.
Right.
So and then there's some war scenes in it, obviously War Horse, so seeing some of the people that gets involved in some of their demises and stuff like that, it's like, ew.
All right.
But he's really good at doing war stuff, I mean, making it. But moving from there, he did Lincoln.
Which I still haven't seen, it's funny because it was filmed in Virginia, like in Richmond area and stuff. And I actually, I'll tell you this. There's an actor that's going to be in Supernatural Assassins that was in Echo Lake and The Invited with us, Robert Shepard. Love him to death. I actually met him on the set before he did this movie, right? Mm-hmm. He came on our set in 2010, you know, okay. It was probably around the time, like probably right before he did Lincoln. He actually got to be the guy that pronounces Lincoln dead at the end of the movie. So he's the doctor that comes in and pronounces Lincoln dead. And, he's going to be working, with us in Supernatural Assassins again. And, I absolutely adore Robert. I think he's amazing. And I'll never forget his, because I asked him, what was it like working with Steven Spielberg? And his response was like, that he is just such an easygoing director, right? And what he does is he'll have like, for that one scene, right? He'll have like five or so different cameras going, right? So it'll be like one on one side, one there, whatever, right? He'll say action. You'll do the scene. Then he'll say cut. You'll come back and he'll give you your direction. And for his direction for him was just, you know, take it down a notch or something, you know, or whatever, you know, like, you know, that was his only direction to Robert, you know, something simple. Right. And he did it. And then he was like, okay, we're done. Cut. Like it didn't take very long. And that made me go, that makes sense for him as a director. You know, like I was very, you know, I was like, okay, because, you know, if you get all the different angles at once, you know, or whatever, and then you shoot, and then, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it seemed like a easy going day, you know what I mean? But, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's awesome.
When you're, 40 some years into the career, and he had all that experience and stuff like that, it's like he pretty much has in his mind, I guess, what he's honestly looking for. And if he sets it up in the multiple shots at one time, he knows what he's got. And that's just the genius. It's filling up two parts of one of these, of these podcasts. It's just continuing to hear that. And I've seen Rob in a lot of local commercials and stuff like that in the area and stuff like that. So
yeah, he's such a great guy.
It's gonna be interesting. Working with him.
Oh, you'll be working with him. Trust me. I'm excited about that. He's such a nice, understanding, easygoing actor to work with. And the fact that he's got to work with Steven Spielberg to me means 7 degrees of, you know, Spielberg, I'm like there, you know, I'm like, you know, all I have to do is work on a set with Spielberg, and then, you know, that's my next thing. Mm-hmm. But you know, even so, even being in one of his war movies, I would definitely take an extra, just being an extra in one of his movies would be something I would, love to do, because, everybody's going to watch it. Everybody's going to love it or whatever, or not love it, because there are some movies that people just don't dig.
Yeah. There was a few of them that we touched on earlier that didn't, resonate as much with us. The last couple movies that he's done, Bridge of Spies.
I always think this is a, Clint Eastwood movie. I don't know, like, just the way that Bridge of Spies sounds, and the everything, even the direction of it. When I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, this is a Clint Eastwood movie. Nope, Spielberg. And I'm like, really? This doesn't feel like, I would have imagined Clint Eastwood being the director of that one. But,
well, I guess that's Bridge of Spies. Is that the first one he directed that had Mark Rylance in it? Because he had that, then he was Rylance was the main the BFG in the BFG. He was the big guy in that, and then he showed up obviously in Ready Player One also. BFG we talked about a little bit on the previous one. Another one of the ones that he's done. Another movie with Hanks and him.
Not really that excited about it, because it doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like one of Steven Spielberg's like gut punch movies, but also doesn't seem like one of his like, you know, just fun, entertaining movies. So it just feels like, okay, he needed a paycheck and they knew that he would do good. You know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, if you put him in there and you have Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, so it seems like it was more of a names movie in it instead of being something bigger. Now, Ready Player One, that one has a little bit of a special place to me. I'm not sure. Have you seen that one?
Yes, I own it. Okay. I even own it on 4K too now. Okay. And yeah, I absolutely adore it. I think it's a great tribute to video games and all that stuff.
Some of his world, and some of, I mean, the segment where it goes into The Shining, recreates that whole universe is amazing. It's kind of a nice bookend to Spielberg, this discussion, because it brings some of the magic and stuff like of some of his earlier movies back to light. And also in a computer sense, in a computer world and futuristic games and stuff like that.
Exactly. I enjoyed it. Like, it's one of my, you know, it's one of my favorite of his newer movies for sure.
I'd put that right there as probably next behind Minority Report in probably the last 20 years or so of the ones that I've seen.
I never read the book, but I was anxious to see it, because I had a lot of friends who had read the book and said the book was amazing. And so a lot of people were like kind of hyping this up and kind of worried too, because a lot of people didn't know if Spielberg could pull this kind of thing off, you know, from the imaginations that everybody had in this world. But you know, it's something I've been, you know, I thought he did a great job. And like, as you said, the Shining scene was probably the best stuff. Plus there was just a million other great, like little nods to video games and.
Back to the Future stuff, the car and was it Kong or all the different, I mean, there were Qbert, I mean, all the little video game stuff. I mean, everything, there was just everywhere you go, it was just, you know,
right.
But yeah, so to me, that was that's a nice bookend for his career right now. But he does have I believe West Side Story coming out this fall, which if he's going to remake something, this isn't exactly the one that I thought he would remake. We were talking earlier about some of the Capra stuff would probably be more of our choosing, but
he is doing it as a musical though. So would this be Spielberg's first musical?
I would think so. I'm trying to think of anything that we went through and
Went
through everything and let he might have done some musical elements in like maybe some of his Amazing Stories TV show or something, but no straight musicals come up to mind to me.
It's so funny that like I'm looking at it, the cast and everything. It's got that Ansel Elgort guy who I absolutely adored Baby Driver, but hated him. I thought, and he's the Baby Driver, like he's baby, you know, which. I just thought he did such a wooden job, and maybe that was his character, but like, it just didn't do anything for me as far as like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. You know, no, he was,
And I remember, if I remember correctly, Rita Moreno is going to be in this one as well. And she was in the original West Side Story.
Oh, so wow.
It's kind of interesting. Obviously she's a teenager or thereabouts there. So, I mean, 60 years later, so she's
I forgot he was in The Fault in Our Stars, which I fucking hated. and I love those writers. They did like 500 Days of Summer, and they did some of the. But I just felt like Fault in Our Stars, and I was so disappointed because also I liked The Spectacular Now, which was made by them. And so I was like, and everybody kept saying, oh, The Fault in Our Stars is so great. It's such a great tearjerker. And I'm like, this movie's so boring. Like, I just could not care. And Ansel was like, and that guy was just so fucking wooden once again. Oh man, I'm not looking forward. Like, he better have taken some acting classes or something. Like, I don't know. I mean, I can't say anything because I haven't done anything like that big as well as he, you know, like as whatever. Like, I'm not the greatest actor, you know, or whatever, but I'm not doing movies like West Side Story yet, you know? So. Yeah.
So one thing that we talked about on the first episode of this is that there's a documentary that's on HBO Max, I believe, right now for Spielberg. It's about 2.5 hours long. It's really long. It was made in 2017, but it's a really good documentary if somebody's really just wanting to continue to learn more about Spielberg. It's from him and from a lot of other people. It's not made by him, but it's a lot of interviews with him and a lot of interviews with other people that's worked with him over the years. And they dig into a lot of his movies, which was really, really a must watch if you're big into Spielberg stuff. So recommend to anybody listening to check that out if they can.
Well, definitely. Well, yeah. So thanks for this. We did get there. We went a little over an hour. Had a feeling that would happen, you know, because there was so much like we said, there's a couple of these movies that we could do our own like film freaks on, and maybe we will, I don't know, someday.
Yeah, we glossed over a few of them, and it's like some of these, I mean, that we glossed over could have used a little bit more time, and then some of the ones we spent a lot of time on could use probably, like you said, full episodes of stuff on. But that just goes to show, and we were going to talk about some of his producing stuff, but it's just his directing is
no
enough
way.
Information.
Yeah, directing is enough. Directing is enough. His producing, he's done like, I think he's done more producing than he's done directing. It's like, Jesus
Christ,
dude. Yeah,
he had like 175 credits.
Well,
like
no.
Or more.
we're good. We're good. Directing is enough. But just so you know, we do love him producing. I mean, he produced like Back to the Future and a ton of other.
That's where, when I was at the movies a couple weeks ago when they first opened the theaters back up, I did a double feature that opening day. And it was Back to the Future and Goonies, and each one Steven Spielberg presents first thing up there, and I'm like, interesting, and they're both from 1985, and I was just like, all right,
He also produced Poltergeist. I mean, he produced a lot of stuff back in the 80s, you know, that a lot of people, I think, did he do The Burbs? Did he produce The Burbs, I think, if I'm right? I could be wrong.
I wouldn't be surprised if I mean, there's Hanks in that too. So, I mean, there's so many of them.
No, Ron Howard did though. So, okay. And Joe Dante, oh wait, he did Gremlins though, didn't he?
I think he produced Gremlins.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You produced Gremlins, I think.
Yeah. And Gremlins to me is, I absolutely love that film beyond. It's got to be one of my favorites to watch. I mean, he executive produced
Gremlins. Oh, he did.
Yeah. So I think he did Gremlins 2 also, which obviously is not
with everybody's favorite producer of the Star Wars saga, Kathleen Kennedy.
Oh yeah.
Everybody fucking hates her now.
I
feel bad because like it's got to be tough, man, taking over for George Lucas. You know, and stuff like, I mean, being like the right-hand woman of like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas at that time, you know, and now like having control over stuff, like it's got to be tough to like make everybody happy, you know, because you're always going to have people that are not going to be happy with whatever you do.
Yeah, well, one of the ones that I watched recently, it was before she was, I don't want to say an assistant, but she wasn't like co-producing it like with all of them yet. She was still in a smaller role. So it was more for earlier stuff, I guess. So, she has gotten a bit of abuse over some of the Star Wars and stuff and different stuff. And
poor girl.
But
I know, right? I mean, poor rich woman, but like in the same sense, I mean, you know, you take chances, you do things to make sure that the project gets made the way that one fan, you know what I mean? Like, that was the problem with, and this isn't a Star Wars talk or whatever, but, and I think we've had our Star Wars talk a little bit, but that's the problem with the, you know, doing the new movies was like, okay, we had J.J. Abrams come in, right, and do the first one, and they're like, some people are like, I love it, some people are like, I hate it. Right. So they were like, okay, let's try to make, you know, whatever. Let's try to make people happy. So they did The Last Jedi, and there were so many people who hated it compared to the people who liked it. And they were like, you know, people are like, why, where's J.J. Abrams? You know, right. Mm-hmm. So they bring him back, and then they're like, you know, like, we don't like this one either now. You know what I mean? Like, there's no pleasing anyone. I looked at those movies. Those new movies, and I was like, they're fun, you know, each, like, even though they might have the same people or whatever, right, you know, each one felt different.
So. Yeah, well, I guess that's where Spielberg stuff seems like it's more universally loved by most people. I know there's a few people who don't necessarily care for his stuff, and but I think just the range of stuff that he's done and that we've touched on over these last two episodes, it really shows the depth that he goes in and some of the background on why some of the themes that he always has in his stories and stuff like that.
Yep.
It's just, and there it's universally.
Universally.
Oh.
You work for Universal a lot.
Yeah. Until he owned his own company now. I guess didn't he create?
Well, he was Amblin, yeah. And then he did DreamWorks. I think co-created that, but I don't think he deals with DreamWorks as much as he, you know, does his own stuff. Like he might probably, you know, have a hand or whatever too, and things, but honestly. I'm proud, you know, I'm proud to say, like, I love his films, you know, generally speaking. Maybe there's a couple I didn't dig or didn't really want to watch. I probably will eventually watch all of them, you know. Just like to Hitchcock, it's hard, man. It's hard because he's done so much, you know. And just like Hitchcock, you can't just do a whole movie on or a whole episode on Hitchcock. We've done that for Hollywood Boulevard for only 45 minutes, and there's a lot you need to talk about, you know, especially, I've watched so many of those movies now that, you know, I definitely would have a say. So Spielberg's up there. I know, like I said, I think I've said before, and we've talked about this on Film Freaks when we did Jaws, you know, that Paul is not a huge fan of Spielberg because of just feels like he's schmaltzy and, you know, he does these, you know, there's only a few Jaws and Close Encounters are his two favorite, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff. I'm not really that into Close Encounters yet. I only watched it once, but I was like, eh, it's okay. I mean, it's not the greatest.
Yeah, it'd probably be in like, probably like number 6 or 7 in my list. Maybe up to 5. It's not like in the top, my top 3 or 4, I wouldn't think. So,
right.
But yeah, it's really well made though. And I mean, but like I said, everything of this is that way. So
definitely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Joe. This has been awesome. We've got through all of his directing films and we've talked a little bit about his producing, but we can't go into so much detail with that. And we're not going to do another episode just on his producing because, good God, that took us, you know, just like freaking Schindler's List took me 3 days to watch. This took us two times to do. So thank you, Spielberg, making everything long. But I enjoyed it. What have you been up to?
Lately, it's just been I have a lot of stuff going on with work, but I'm looking to getting out of that mode in the coming months, and hopefully working on some stuff with you on getting some stuff moving to happen really soon.
Which is great because this is going to release on the day, it's releasing on Friday, which is the day that we release the Indiegogo for Supernatural Assassins, which is our biggest Indiegogo we're planning to ever do in our lives, at least for now, until the next one. But, you know, or whatever, like if we get a good amount of money on this one, we'll definitely try to do it, you know, more on the next one, you know, like that's the hope. But, you know, we are playing, this is going to be an amazing movie. We are so excited. This is just, there's so much amazing stuff happening. I absolutely adore, you know, this the project. So Joe will be first ADing, and I'm sure we'll get you a part in the show too. I think I'm going to have you as a, I just announced this, or I just said this to, Alfred recently, but I think I'm gonna have you and Alfred as deputies, you know, in the show. You know, I think that would be a lot of fun to have you guys, you know, because you know, if I'm gonna make this show, I want to make it very much Indie Film Cafe presents in a way, you know, like
yeah.
I have a lot of the people from my podcast and stuff, and I do, I have a lot of people from the podcast that are gonna be in it and work on it, and all the different podcasts. So But yep, so there should be a link to it at the bottom of this thing. So check that out. Let us know. Check out the Indiegogo. Since this is day one, please, please, please donate. If this is day 2 or day 3 or whatever that you're listening to this, please still donate because we need as much help as we can get every day for 2 months or so or whatever it's going to be that we're going to release it. So I'm excited. Are you excited?
Absolutely. Let's get stuff rolling.
Yeah, definitely. but aside from that, yeah, so we've got Indie Film Cafe stuff going on. Next year, Joe will be our co-host for Hollywood Boulevard podcast. But we're finishing up this year with just being Alfred, I think. So, but we did have you for a couple episodes. That was pretty cool.
Yes, that was fun.
Yeah, it was fun to have you as a guest on that, but you'll be back later for the full like stuff. So I'm really excited. There's just so much going on right now. And I want you all to enjoy it with us. So please get checking back the different podcasts that we do and everything and keep checking out the give us moolah as Paul would say. See, I can't put him on this one, but we might be able to get him as a guest on the Halloween one, the original Halloween movie, because that is what we're doing next, everybody. We're going to be talking about the original, I think, right? Wasn't that our plan?
I believe that's It's either the next one or the one after. I think it's the next one because I think that's the last one, right?
Yeah, the last one, probably. I mean, I don't want to make it definite, like, this is going to be, like, next one is the final mainstream episode. But I think it is taking a little bit of a break, at least, you know? So if it ever comes back, it might be a little bit different or have different people involved or something, you know? But keep checking with the Hollywood Boulevard podcast, because that's pretty much what the mainstream will be, you know? So that we're going to be back with that. I think Alfred and I have 3 more episodes to do. So we got 1 to do tomorrow that were for September, you know, so there you go. If you stick around, I'll chat with you afterwards. But everybody else, thank you guys so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And tell us, what is your favorite Steven Spielberg movie? And what is your least favorite? That's what I want to know. I want to know what your least favorite one is. Is it Amistad? I think it's going to be Amistad.
I think another thing is, what's your favorite other than Jaws? If everybody's coming back with Jaws, what other?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or, like, what's one of your, like, favorite obscure ones, you know? The ones that aren't, like, the top. Like, don't tell us E.T. or don't tell us Jurassic Park. Don't tell us whatever. Tell us Sugarland Express or The Color Purple or all those movies that, you know, that don't get the limelight, you know, as much when they should. Because even though you might not like Sugarland Express enough to, like, watch it over and over again, you know, it's probably somebody's favorite, you know, movie of his. We didn't even talk about Always or whatever, I think, or we kind of briefly talked about it in the last one. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's so many. So tell us what's your, like, more obscure favorite one. So, all right. Well, thank you guys. Hope you guys enjoyed this, and check us out on the flip side later. Bye.
Later. Bye.